looking for a few good folks who aren't scared of false rumors. And I'm willing to sweeten the pie a little. I know you've all got a taste for what's in here.
He opened the tub and showed them the heap of white, crystalline powder it contained.
This is the real thing, people! 100% pure jolt! It'll make you feel 10 feet tall, and you'll screw my pretty little sluts like a pack of slag heap weasels. But don't push now, one at a time. Come and get it.
Ooh, that big bear is mine.
Using a battered teaspoon, he laid a heaping dose of powder on every outstretched palm. Though some people licked it, most snorted it. The powerful drug took hold quickly with alarming effect. It made eyes bug out and sweaty faces grimace spastically. To quench their suddenly raging thirsts, the revelers guzzled more free joy juice, and they all fell into a slow-spinning, half-speed dance. At a signal from Mike, the music abruptly stopped, and the three whores climbed down from the roof with the boombox. They entered the bus and walked past Huth, heading straight for the pile of mattresses in the back.
Come on in my magic bus, people. The real fun's starting. Slip and slide, people. Slip and slide.
As stoned as they were, most of the Byram Villers didn't fall for his spiel, but they were in no shape to try to stop the few who did. Four men between the ages of 20 and 30 and a heavy-set 30-ish woman mounted the bus's steps.
Come to mama, you hairy bitch.
As the woman passed Huth and turned down the aisle for the rear, she jerked her black sleeveless t-shirt over her head and tossed it aside. Her huge, soft breasts swayed pendulously as she struggled with a zipper on the front of her dusty BDU pants.
Hey, it's okay if you don't want to come with me now. I'll be back by here in a week or two. Give you all some time to think it over. Maybe I'll even bring back your friends for a visit. You can hear firsthand what you're missing.
With that, he climbed back in the bus, started it up, and U-turned for the checkpoint. Huth took a seat up front, right behind the driver, as far away from the goings-on in the back as he could get.
Woo! Give it to me, baby!
After they cleared the gate, Mike double-clutched and shifted the bus into high gear.
How about some driving music?
Dreda Otis Trask deepened the tint of her helmet visor to shield her eyes against Slake City's blinding panoramic glare. From the history of her own Earth, she knew that there had once been a vast body of water in this place, the last remnant of an ancient inland sea. In Shadow World's reality, on a late January day more than a century past, Great Salt Lake had been vaporized by a multi-warhead nuclear strike. And a fraction of an instant later, the sands of the exposed lake bed and the shattered metropolis of Salt Lake City were melted together, fused into a boiling 100-square-mile sea of thermoglass. As the infernal heat was sucked up into the atmosphere, towering waves of glass solidified in a nightmare snapshot, their peaks capped with a foam of rusting, fire-blackened litter. Massive shock blast-tossed fragments, skyscraper I-beams, sections of railroad track, and metal utility poles stuck up from the wave troughs like the masts of a drowned navy. It was a place long dead, but it was neither silent nor still. Between howling gusts of wind, the external microphones of Dreda's battlesuit picked up what sounded like scattered, desperate cries of abandoned infants. There were no lost babies out there. The phenomenon had to do with the new glass's structural weaknesses, which were caused by mineral impurities and by the pulverized debris and air bubbles it contained. Extreme changes in day-night temperatures caused hairline cracks to appear in the matrix, and as the splits spread and ran, they made the shrill, disturbing sounds. Occasionally, there were much louder noises. As the fine cracks branched out, they became networks of fissures that eventually crashed down the roofs of hidden hollow spots. Some of these collapsed air pockets were the size of amphitheaters. Dreda focused her attention on a distant column of human figures moving away from her, over the gray-green surface. The group of freshly captured slaves walked a road that ended at Ground Zero, some 8 miles away from Slake City. A pair of huge black vehicles dogged the rear of the file, herding the work crew replacements. In the week that it had taken to complete road construction, Dreda had sacrificed half of the Shadow World workforce she'd pressed into service. Most of the slaves were young men who had been mining their meager living from the dead city. They had used crude hand tools to hack holes in the surface and crawled into the hollow places in search of undamaged pre-Armageddon odds and ends, which they then traded. As a rule, these independent scroungers only worked the outer edges of the new class, where the lingering radiation was the weakest. Even so, after a few years of digging, most had developed angry sores and large visible tumors. At Ground Zero, tissue destruction proceeded much more briskly. After a few days in that high-dose radioactive environment, weeping blisters appeared on unshielded hands, faces, and feet. Based on the rad exposure alone, the working lifespan of a slave was no more than 2 weeks. Because of other dangers related to large-scale mining and thermoglass, actual survival time was half that. From Dreda's point of view, this wasn't entirely a negative. There was no need to feed slaves who were only going to live a week. Her own survival, and ultimately the conquest of Shadow World, depended on the exploitation of local energy sources. The Recon Satellite's first mission, post-launch, had been to pinpoint the nearest, hottest nuke zone, a place that could provide the suitable raw material for her reprocessing units. The energy reprocessors utilized strains of genetically engineered bacteria that feasted on irradiated inorganic matter and secreted usable nuclear fuel. Every critical component of Dreda's invasion force, from gyroplanes to battlesuits, was powered by this recycled material. The skirmish Dreda had planned for this day would easily gobble up one-third of the precious little fuel that had been harvested from Slake City so far, but she had no choice in the matter. To stabilize the energy stockpile in the short term, she had to expand her mining operation, and to do that, given the life expectancy of her workers, she needed a much larger labor pool. Behind her, 8 huge landships waited, their nuke turbines humming at idle. Gleaming black and windowless, with smooth aerodynamic contours, the 6x6s were the core of her ground force. Able to traverse at high speed the most difficult terrain, thanks to their 7-foot diameter wheels, each with its own independent drivetrain and suspension. As Dreda turned for her flagship, its right front door rose up like the wing of a great bird. Sunlight washed over the high-backed co-pilot seat, over a ceiling tangled with exposed conduit, wiring harnesses, and gray Kevlar pipe. A fine film of desert dust coated the gangway steps. Sitting in the cockpit's other chair, behind the steering yoke, was Miro. Her pale blue eyes gleamed through her battlesuit's transparent visor. Her close-cropped blonde curls were partially hidden by a red skullcap. Like all the officers of Dreda's invasion force, Miro was the product of level 4 genetic engineering. The experimental procedure had made her face less round, and her chin more square and prominent. The look of supreme confidence in her eyes, an expression that 4 tours with the dreaded Population Control Service hadn't dimmed, was now reinforced by additional bone structure and dense layers of muscle. Dreda understood exactly what Miro was feeling at that moment. Excitement, impatience, and an intense curiosity about the future. The two women, indeed all the level 4 females, shared a bond that went deeper than their rank or sex, or the war upon Shadow World they were about to wage. They were all sister changelings, birthed in the same stainless steel womb, explorers of a new universe without, and an equally mysterious and promising one within. This visceral connection, this transgenic sisterhood, was something Dreda hadn't expected to feel so deeply, and it caught her unprepared. As much of the sense of belonging pleased her, it also unsettled her. She'd never experienced anything quite like it before, not even with her own father. Looking between the cockpit seats to the rear of the vehicle, Dreda checked the rest of her crew. The male troops were strapped cross-chest into 12 shock-mounted jump seats set between I-beams along the walls of the cargo bay. Judging from the uniformly smug expressions behind their visors, they no longer had any fear of the enemy. During the slave raids on Slake City scrounger camps, they'd absorbed barrages of fire from a variety of primitive combustion-powered rifles, shotguns, and pistols. Their battlesuits had deflected every projectile with ease. Their own battle gear, tri-barreled laser rifles, and phage foam back tanks was netted, rattle-proofed, and lashed down to the middle of the cargo deck. When Dreda sat down in the co-pilot seat, it immediately adjusted itself, inflating and deflating to match the curves and overlapping plates of her battlesuit. The windshield in front of her was dead black. When the wing door hissed down and locked shut, the only available light came from the instrument panel. It bathed the WAG's interior in hellish red. Greta coupled her battle suit to the dashboard umbilical and opaqued her visor. Immediately, the instrument lights and blacked-out windows vanished, as did the entire outer skin of the vehicle. Suddenly, Greta was sitting